from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forum's opening hour this morning, 7 million acres of bee habitat will be restored over the next 5 years in an effort by the federal government to reverse the decline of the United States honeybee population. The matter is urgent. Beekeepers lost more than 40% of their colonies in 2014, according to a federal report. And the plan also calls for investing more money in research, but some environmentalists say bolder action is needed, including restrictions on pesticides that studies have linked to honeybee colony collapse disorder. We'll discuss President Obama's plan, as well as the impact the drought is having on the state's bees. Join us for Forum. It's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. President Obama announced last week that 7 million acres of bee habitat will be restored over the next 5 years, and an EPA proposal up for public comment would create temporary pesticide-free zones where certain plants are in bloom near bees brought into farms by professional beekeepers. These actions are motivated principally out of concern for the future of a diminished honeybee population and other pollinators, and we discuss in this hour what this is all about. Let me tell you who is joining us. Eric Musson is with us by phone. He's Extension AP Culturalist Emeritus with UC Davis's Department of Entomology and joins us from UC Davis. And welcome to the program, Professor Musson.
Thank you, Michael. Good morning.
Good morning to you. We'll also say good morning to Claire Kremen, who is here with us in studio. She's Professor of Environmental Science, Policy and Management at UC Berkeley and Faculty Director at the Berkeley Food Institute. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Kendall Sager, who is also with us in studio, Education and Outreach Coordinator for the Beekeepers Guild of San Mateo County. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have all of you. And Eric Musson, let me begin with you. This is certainly disturbing. There are reports of almost 40% of colonies that have been lost. What are we talking about here? I mean, it's a mystery in many ways. I read about bee nutrition because of lack of the proper foods. I read about toxic pesticides, about pathogens, about parasites. But the bees are reducing in number dramatically.
The colony numbers actually are staying relatively similar from year to year now and have for about the last 5 years. However, in order to keep those numbers up, the beekeepers have had to take their larger colonies and split them into two or three smaller colonies, wait for them to build back up. And during that period of time, they're not good for pollination purposes. They're not making honey. So we can keep our numbers up, and we usually have enough of them for work in the almonds in the springtime. But then after that, we have a very difficult time keeping them alive. And so all this rebuilding is hurting the bottom line of the beekeepers.
Well, what do you think about the president's plan? I mean, it seems like there's going to be more land and more attempt to protect bees and more of an attempt to really stabilize the population.
Yes, that idea would be extremely good for a couple of reasons. Not only would it probably help honeybees, but it would also help the other native pollinators out there that aren't doing a heck of a lot better than our honeybees right now. It's a really rough world in many places in the country. The interesting thing is it sounds like an astronomically large number of acres, but you do have to remember one thing. A honeybee colony during the active part of the season needs about an acre equivalent of forage plants daily in order to meet its nutritional needs. And so it doesn't have to be a solid acre of something planted in one spot. If that happens, it's easier on the bees. But they do have to have an acre equivalent of bloom that they're visiting. So that 7 million acres sounds huge, but we've got, you know, 2.5, approaching 3 million colonies of commercial honeybees in the United States. And then there are a lot of non-commercial beekeepers now. And, you know, we'll eat up the food on that close to 7 million acres. Well,
at this point, though, I think I was saying, actually, let me bring Claire Kremen into this. I was saying before we went on the air that a lot of folks know from high school biology about photosynthesis and pollinating. And by the way, when Professor Musson mentions other pollinators, butterflies are seriously at risk, too. Migrations are at risk, but we've got bats, birds, insects, and so forth. I think most people don't realize how much the food supply is dependent on.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's we can thank a pollinator for about one out of every three bites of food that we eat. So and in addition to that, not just one third of our food supply, but the diversity of crops that we produce, about 75% of crops that we produce will benefit from the visit of a pollinator. That means they'll produce more seeds or larger seeds, more fruits, larger fruits, even more tasty fruits. And so it's super important from a micronutrient perspective, because those are a lot of the things that are so important for a healthy diet and for an enjoyable diet, like blueberries and apples and almonds and kiwi fruits and avocados and all kinds of things. And I like to say that even chocolate, that's the other vitamin C, requires a pollinator. In this case, it's a tiny midge. So we wouldn't have chocolate if we didn't have all these pollinators around, including the midges.
And fruits and nuts and vegetables.
Yep.
and so many other things. What about the problem of big ag and all this, or for that matter of weed removal? How much does that play into the concern about bees and the bee population, or the monarch population for that matter?
Well, I think big ag plays in a lot of ways. And big ag is one of the reasons that drives why we are so reliant on honeybees. And I should mention also that in addition to honeybees, there are thousands, literally thousands of native bees. In this country, we have 4,000 native bee species. In California alone,
the honeybees are not indigenous. They're invasive.
Right.
Well,
the honeybees have been introduced. We brought them in originally for wax and then later for honey and now for pollination. So the native pollinators, native bees, we have 1,500 species just in California alone. So where does the big ag play in is that it's really changed the way that we do farming. When we have large fields that are all planted in the same thing, in other words, a monoculture, a pollinator-dependent crop like almond then blooms at one single point in time, like in February. There's tons of bloom, and you just need an army of pollinators to pollinate all that almond. And that's why we're so reliant now on the honeybees. We have to bring a million colonies every year to California to pollinate those almonds. But at the same time with the monoculture, what happens is that it doesn't provide a lot of a sequence of floral resources that would keep either honeybees healthy or keep our native pollinators going, because they need to access different kinds of pollens and nectars, and they need something throughout the year to support them. And so if you're only growing this one crop, then there aren't a lot of other things around to support those pollinators. So what happens is on the monoculture farms, we have this huge demand for pollinators, and at the same time, we don't have it a supply from the native pollinators, because that's not good habitat for them.
And what about the pesticides? I mean, let's talk about their role in all of this, because there is in this federal rule that's been put forward by the EPA at least an attempt to do something about pesticides.
Right. Well, with the monoculture, again, you become more reliant as well on pesticides, because it's sort of the best possible conditions for the pest organism is out there, just, you know, miles and miles of the same crop. And again, the monoculture is not providing the resources, the floral resources and the nesting sites for the natural predators that could control those crop pests.
And excuse me, hasn't it been proven that it's toxic to the immune system of bees? So we're talking about, you know, a serious killer, like side
well,
suggests.
You're talking about the neonicotinoid pesticides,
yes,
right now.
Yes, which we'll talk about.
So yeah, I mean, there's lots of scientific evidence that shows that neonicotinoid pesticides are at high enough doses are lethal to individuals. But one of the things that is a big concern are the chronic and sublethal effects that might be happening, or the subacute effects. And this can affect their immune system. It can affect their foraging behavior. So, for example, honeybee goes out to forage to get pollen and bring back to the colony, and it never makes it back home because its navigation system has been interrupted. So, but neonics are only one type of pesticide. There are literally hundreds of pesticides being used out there. And one of the concerns is also how do these things interact and mix?
I'm amazed at the number of pesticides there are. I'm also amazed at the number of bees there are. I mean, it's been a whole education for me.
Right.
Again, Claire Kremen is Professor of Environmental Science, Policy and Management at UC Berkeley and Faculty Director at the Berkeley Food Institute. And Eric Musson, as I said, is Extension Apiculturalist Emeritus at UC Davis's Department of Entomology. And let me go back to you for a moment here, Professor Musson, and just get your read about the pesticides. I mean, they're... There's a good deal of public comment that's going to come in before this present proposal will go through. But the EPA also wants states and tribes, in fact, to have pollinator protection plans. It's been talking about encouraging the public to plant a pollinator garden. This is a big concern for natural habitats, too.
Yes. If people plant a succession of blooming plants on their property, doesn't really matter which ones they are. There will be bees around that use them, particularly the native pollinators. The honeybees, as we already talked about, require an awful lot of food on a daily basis, so the contribution from each backyard wouldn't be huge in amount. But the interesting thing is the micronutrients that they need. If they can get this nice blend of pollen out there, they don't need tons and tons of a lot of the different types, but they need a little bit of all these to make sure those micronutrients are in there to keep their nutritional balance the way it should be.
Well, I'm sorry, but what about pesticides? Go ahead.
So pesticides, my first generality is the word side, C-I-D-E, or the letters, that means meant to kill.
Yeah.
So if it's an insecticide, it kills the insects. A fungicide kills fungi. So no matter which one of those the bees happen to bump into out in the field, bring back to the hive, you know, et cetera, any bee that comes exposed to the residue of that material is going to have to turn on its detoxification system in order to get it out of its body. Just like a human that drinks alcohol or smokes a cigarette, their detoxification system has to come on and get that out of their body as well. So there's some energy going into that. And then it just seems like malnutrition, the bees don't quite have the energy that they should have. And then if you begin to bring in the parasites that feed on them, particularly if they get inoculated with a virus or something, now you've turned on the immune system. The problem is they're weakened already. They just run out of energy to run all their systems, and finally they cave in. And sometimes they cave into chemicals, sometimes they cave into disease. It's hard to say. But it looks like the major problem that we've got out here is our bees are just too weak now, if you want to call it that. They're not healthy. They're not robust.
Yeah, and let me make clear, by the way, I hope there's not confusion about this. The EPA proposal is separate from the White House plan. The White House plan does not have any restrictions on pesticides. The EPA is proposing some, and Lorianne Bird, I believe, feels maybe those proposals don't go far enough. She's an environmental health director and staff attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity, and we have her on the line here. Lorianne Bird, welcome. You're on the program.
Thank you.
Good morning to you. What are your concerns about what's being proposed as far as the federal rule on pesticides, which, by the way, will be under public comment and will presumably not go into effect until next spring? I mean, you're concerned about pesticides, but this doesn't go far enough?
That's right. I'm glad to see the White House Pollinator Task Force taking action, but just as you said, it doesn't go enough. Countless studies have found that pesticides and particularly systemic insecticides are leading cause of pollinator declines. The White House Task Force calls for more study and evaluations, but our bees don't have time for that. We need to ban these insecticides now.
Is this like a mystery in many ways, though, like the frog population? I started out by asking Eric Musson about that. I mean, if there are clearly connections to the toxicity of pesticides, are there, we're talking about multi-factors here, many other things perhaps too?
There are many things that are harming our bees. There's no question about that, and we've talked about some of them already on the show today. But neonicotinoids and systemic insecticides are potent neurotoxins. So even at very low levels of exposure, the bees that encounter them are fundamentally weakened, and so all the other factors facing them become significantly more lethal.
And so what do you recommend? What would you like to see brought to fruition?
Well, first and foremost, we need EPA to ban the use of systemic insecticides as seed treatments. In their report, they proposed creating 7 million acres of new habitat for pollinators, and that's wonderful. But we use these poison seeds on over 100 million acres in the U.S., and by simply eliminating that use, which is prophylactic and is not actually aimed at any particular pest infestation, we can create 100 million acres of habitat that are not actually actively killing bees.
Well, I appreciate very much your joining us. Again, that's Lorianne Bird, who is Environmental Health Director and Staff Attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity. And again, Clara Kremen is here, Professor of Environmental Science, Policy and Management at UC Berkeley and Faculty Director at the Berkeley Food Institute. Professor Kremen, do we know the effect of the drought on this? I was reading where President of California Beekeepers, and we're going to talk in a moment with Kendall Sager, who is a beekeeper, but this is a guy named Bill Lewis who manages 50 billion bees, and he said the honey production is down 20%, and he says a lot of it has to do with the drought.
Mm-hmm. Well, that seems likely since, you know, they have to get nectar in order to produce honey, and Eric Musson has really told us how much nectar they need and how much land they need to access that. So I think it's probably a combination of the drought and, again, interacting with other factors. One of the big problems, not just for honeybees, but again for our native pollinators, is the lack of forage. And that means the lack of flowers. And so as we have these bigger farm fields that don't even allow weeds to grow on them, there's just fewer and fewer floral resources where, you know, the agriculture competes with natural habitat and even with weeds to, in terms of what's growing out there. So we do need more floral resources as well. And we need to get climate change under control. There's undoubtedly.
How much of a factor is that, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think climate change is a factor that affects everything biological and, of course, us in many, many ways.
And Kendall Sager is Education and Outreach Coordinator with the Beekeepers Guild of San Mateo County. And I should mention she has 7 hives. Are you seeing less production as a result of the kinds of things we're talking about here?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, with less water around, a lot of people are stopping watering lawns, other plants. So there's not only less blooming and less available for the foragers, but there's less leaks in faucets, which they're typically collecting water to either cool the hive or adjust the viscosity of the honey. So I've seen anywhere from 75% to 50% of the honey that I was typically getting before.
And you harvest 3 times a year, is that right?
Just about. I mean, you can harvest at various points throughout the year. I just try to minimize the number of times that I harvest because it's a very sticky, laborious process. So that's why I only do 3.
It's not easy being a beekeeper, is it?
Well, I mean, out of all the pets that you could potentially have, bees are probably one of the most low-key. Like, you can still go on vacation. They really manage themselves for the most part. And I'm just kind of helping them along because I've put them in this artificial hive situation. But it's typically less work than a cat or a dog.
What about the so-called slow hives? Those are coming more into vogue now. How are they different?
Is that the flow hives? So flow hives, this was created by a group of Australians, and it's a pretty cool innovation. So they've been marketing it as honey on tap. So you essentially turn a tap and harvest some honey. There's been some skepticism about these sorts of hives because it kind of implies you can just walk into your backyard and have honey whenever you want. So you still have to be a beekeeper to keep this type of hive. You still need to manage the bees. It just takes out a lot of that laborious process.
Let me bring Eric Musson back into the discussion. Go back to the drought again, Eric Musson. I think you went through the drought, the last drought. And so what are you seeing in the way of differences here and their impact on the bee population?
Well, the bee population, as I said before, if you want to talk about the commercial beekeepers in the state, they do a pretty good job of keeping your bees alive and going. But if you want to talk about the effects that drought has had on, let's say, honey production, which is one you can really measure, when I arrived here and up through normal rain seasons, I think the average honey production per colony in California is around 60 pounds. But back in 1976 and 7, during that time when it was really dry, and currently we're only getting somewhere, I think the last record said we got, I don't know, it's 32 pounds or something. And see, that's way, way down. And on a wet year, we had a really wet year back in the end of the 80s, well, a couple of times, once in the 80s, once in the 90s, we got a heavy, heavy rainfall. And those years, we were averaging 90 pounds a colony. So the amount of moisture that we get and how well the plants grow and produce nectar and whatnot really can be can be read in the amount of honey production that's coming out of this state.
Well, what about the government plan again for more varied food? We've been talking a lot about the nutrition for bees and the need for bees to, aside from pesticide and the drought and all the rest of that, just to have the kind of foraging food that's necessary that Professor Kremen was talking about. If you have this federal land and you have all of this essentially food that's set aside for the bees, what's the ultimate impact going to be? In many respects, it almost sounds like perhaps we're at a juncture now where maybe we can't do as much as we'd like to do or hope to do.
Well, I think you have to be judicious about what you're planting and where you're planting it, because some of the things that might work very well in the Midwest, which is where a lot of this problem has been developing, would not necessarily work out here in the drier locations, almost semi-desert-like, of California. So generally, if you can do this, if you can plant the plants that can hang in there in the environment, which are normally the native plants that are there, and get those up and get those going, but still, even in California, the native plants relied on this rain we were supposed to be getting in the winter, and so they're being stressed too. I think we'll find places where we used to be able to find certain naturally occurring native plants out there, wildflowers, and their numbers are just dropping. And it's not necessarily because the pollinators aren't there, but it's just that the plants now are being stressed, as are the bees being stressed, and they're not producing as well, and there are not as many seeds, not as many plants. This drought is really, really, devastating in lots of ways, including on the natural environment.
Talking about a whole range of things related to bees, about collapsing colonies of bees, about pesticides' effect on the health of bees, also about the importance of pollinators on our food supply and the concern about bees. And again, I want to separate the EPA proposal from the proposal of the Obama administration, which is going into effect. The EPA proposal about pesticides is still up for public comment, and this program is up for public comment as well. You may want to join us with comments you have or concerns about the pollinator population. Not only talk about bees, as I said earlier, but butterflies, particularly monarchs at serious risk, and bats and insects and birds and, what makes the world go around, but also what affects what you eat and your diet to a great degree. I should also say that the president's plan has three overarching parts of it. One is to reduce the honeybee losses to economically sustainable levels. The second is to increase monarch butterfly numbers to protect the annual migration. And the third is to restore or enhance millions of acres of land for pollinators through combined public and private actions. We welcome your phone calls, and we welcome you to the program and the conversation, and invite you to call us now at our toll-free number to join the program. That number is 866-733-6786. How concerned are you about the bee population? What do you feel ought to be done, and what would you like to see done? Again, you may want to comment on the EPA proposal or the president's proposal, which is going into effect. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Other ways to join the conversation, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Talking with Claire Kremen from UC Berkeley and Eric Musson from UC Davis and Kendall Sager of the Beekeepers Guild of San Mateo County, and you, our callers and listeners, when we return on Forum, I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about bees to a great extent, but other pollinators as well. President Obama has dedicated land and money to honeybee restoration, talking about that as well as a proposal by the EPA, which has to do with eliminating or at least diminishing the number of pesticides that are used that are thought to have a toxic effect on bees. Claire Kremen with us is professor of environmental science, policy, and management at UC Berkeley and faculty director at the Berkeley Food Institute. Eric Musson with us by phone is Extension AP Culturalist Emeritus at UC Davis's Department of Entomology, and Kendall Sager in studio with us as Education and Outreach Coordinator with the Beekeepers Guild of San Mateo County. Where ideally, Eric Musson, would you think or like this money to go in terms of research?
Well, I think there are still a lot of questions that we have that are important and have not been answered well yet. And you hit on one of them already, and that is the case that in the older days, if you will, when a pesticide went into the field, the bees got into it, and they came back and died at the hive and whatnot. We knew they had been poisoned. But then when the pyrethroids came along, they started to drop dead in the field instead, and we didn't see so many dead bees at the hive. But now things have become even more subtle. And it appears as though materials that, if you test them in the lab individually on bees, adult bees or whatnot, you don't see any negative results to having them exposed, whether they have it put on their bodies or whether they eat it. It doesn't seem to matter. So we consider them, not really toxic to bees. But you kind of blend those together out in the field and spray them when a crop is in bloom, and the bees get into them. They bring them back to the hive, and it ends up in the stored food. And as it's consumed by the colony and converted from pollen into bee food, particularly for the larvae and whatnot, we begin to see these very severe effects on the brood. We lose a whole lot of brood. The bees get very sick brood-wise and whatnot, which means you're not going to have replacement bees after a period of time. Your colony shrinks instead of building up the way it should. I would like to see more money put into that. And there's this whole group of pesticides out there that are called adjuvants, and neither EPA nor the California Department of Pesticide Regulation requires testing to see whether or not those are toxic to bees. So there is some work going on right now at Penn State, and there indeed is toxicity in some of those adjuvants. So, it's more subtle now. It's not quite as straightforward as it used to be, but I would like to see a lot more research into that area to find out what these chemicals are actually doing to both the adult and immature bees as they develop.
And Claire Kremen, do you want to add to that, or sure. What would you like to see research money going to?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first I want to say that, it's really fantastic that we have a national pollinator strategy in the first place. I mean, this is kind of unprecedented. And I should say as well that they have developed a pretty comprehensive research action plan. So it's already, it's already established, which is great. But I do think that there is one major gap, and it comes also from the stance of the whole strategy itself, which in a way doesn't question the continued use of pesticides. And as Eric mentioned before, it has that CIDE, that side, and it is killing insects. So
say the same thing about herbicide.
right. Herbicides kill weeds. So anyway, the strategy really kind of starts from the point that pesticides are something that we have to have, that we cannot do without. And it actually says, and I quote, "It is the misuse and overuse of these pesticides that leads to adverse ecological and human health consequences." So that's kind of saying we have to have these pesticides, we just have to use them right. And it's not questioning the actual, paradigm of pesticide usage, which is what I think we should be questioning. And so, to me...
Just gotta go back and read Rachel Carson.
Well, yeah. But a major research gap here is to identify alternatives to pesticide use and to extend findings and help people who need to use pesticides, whether it's growers, whether it's the Forest Service, anyone using pesticides to use these alternatives.
Okay, I want to get our listeners involved in this, but say something quickly about habitat and its importance here as you see it.
Okay, and also on the Obama plan for habitat, again, I think it's fantastic that they're making these efforts to set aside these 7 million acres for habitat for honeybees and also for the monarch. It's big chunks of land, and so that's really great. But my concern is that we're kind of focusing on these two iconic insects, and there are so many other native pollinators out there. So there's a lot more that could be done. So hopefully this will be a starting point.
And we're going to go to our callers here, but Kendall Sager, say something as a beekeeper about maybe what ordinary citizens can do in their own backyard and all that.
Sure. Other than being a beekeeper, one of the easier things you can do is to, like Eric and Claire have mentioned, is like have this variety of plants that are blooming throughout the year. And that way, this nutrition is available for the bees all year round. Pollinator.org and the Xerxes Society have some really great drought-tolerant, pollinator-friendly plant lists that you can get for California. Just to name a few of those, there's the California poppy, which is, of course, native. lavender, which is thought to maybe have some beneficial properties for the bees in addition to just being great for your garden, and rosemary, which blooms in the winter. And so the bees will be on it in January and December. And when you're planning out your garden, try to plant them in clusters, so of the same flower. And that way, honeybees can be a little more efficient in collecting because they'll visit hundreds to a few thousand flowers on one foraging trip, and they'll visit only one type of flower during that trip. So that's the best way I think you can help in your home garden.
They're picky, huh?
Yeah, they're certainly very picky.
All right, let's pick some of our callers out to join us, and we begin, Fred, with you. Join us.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Fred Bovey. I'm calling from San Francisco. I just want to dovetail off of Kendall's comment about creating habitat and bring listeners' attention to a couple resources that they can use to actually participate in this issue. One is the, as she mentioned, the Xerces Society. It's spelled XERCES.org. If you go on their website, there's a downloadable Conserving Bumblebees Guidelines for Creating and Managing Habitat. And it's a really great guideline for planting flowers and plants that can be used as forage. You can also participate in citizen science projects. I was involved as the outreach director for the Great Sunflower Project, greatsunflower.org. We had 50,000 individuals across the United States measuring the number of bee visits they get to a sunflower or other flowers, and measuring that across years to track decline in pollinator service. Another great project is Bumblebee Watch. That's where folks can observe bumblebees and send in their observations to scientists. These citizen scientists initiatives are very important because they provide data that back up a lot of the types of legislation and decisions that are being made about devoting resources to conserving pollinators.
Well, so I, Fred, it's good of you to provide us with that information. In fact, much appreciated, and I thank you for it. Citizen initiatives, indeed. More data. Let me get another caller. John, hi, you're on.
Hi. First thing I'm going to say is I've got some poppies, I've got some lavender, and a lot of rosemary. I would like to say make sure to plant them separate from the other things, just because they do like to take over. But for my questions, is there really an economic reason we're focused on these neonicotinoids or neonicotinoids? Is there a reason why are they that much cheaper? And secondly, why don't we focus on more natural barrier crops, you know, things like planting more milkweed for the monarchs and other flowers rather than just rotating crops and crops and crops?
Yeah, Claire Crumman.
Yeah, on the neonicotinoids, there's some interesting new data out on that, actually from the EPA. They've just done a report on the economic benefits of the seed treatment on neonicotinoids, and it turns out there is no economic benefit for that. So it's with these seed with these seed treatments, which are now extremely pervasive, it's about 100% of the corn is seed treated and 70% of the soy. You have to ask the question, who is benefiting from this if there isn't an economic benefit? There's also been
Have an answer to that question or surmising?
Maybe? I would surmise that the
somewhat rhetorical question.
The pesticide companies, which are actually sort of pesticide and seed companies combined, are the ones that are benefiting.
Let me thank you, John, for that call and go to an email here. And Eric, I'm going to go to you on this one. Eric Musson is with us at UC Davis's Department of Entomology. Garth writes, it seems that lately a lot of attention is being put on the pesticides affecting the bees. I am in no way condoning the use of pesticides, but pesticides have been in use for a half century, and only just recently are we seeing a decline. Doesn't seem to line up. Has there been a shift in pesticides use, or could cell phones and the move to a wireless society be having a more direct effect on bees?
Well, I don't necessarily believe that cell phones have much to do with this. But the rest of their environment has something to do with it. And we mentioned before, it's a combination of a bunch of stressors and whatnot. If you want to talk about neonics, why are they a little bit different? What's going on? They put them on the seed. The material, as the plant grows, the material is taken in by the roots and goes all the way through the plant everywhere. If the plant comes into bloom, the materials end up in the nectar and pollen. But that was sold to the EPA as an approach to use because you therefore were not out taking your planes or whatever it was and flying around and blanketing the universe with pesticides because you had some insects on the plants you wanted to get rid of. So the whole idea was confine the treatment to the plant and you won't be wrecking the environment. But there's consequences not only to the bugs that suck and chew on the plants and die, but then we've got this material moving in low levels into the food sources of all these pollinators. And on honeybees, there's kind of a buffer system because the material comes in, it's eaten by the bees, and then it's processed by the bees, and it finally gets to the larvae and all that sort of thing. Claire's work on the native bees, though, that pollen is going directly into the, I call them the dough ball, but it's a mixture of pollen and nectar that are provided for the larva that's going to eat that in that nest. And boy, that's getting the material basically straight, or at least at the level it comes out of the plants. And there's no buffer. There's honeybee colonies, there's that buffer. And the other thing I would like to say is it can't be as simple as removing the neonicotinoids from the environment, you know, to make everything work right. Because if you go to a place like Australia, I believe that their use of neonicotinoids is at least the same as or even a higher percentage of what we're doing here in the U.S., and they are not suffering from these problems. Their bees are still, you know, functioning fairly well. So that combination of having this varroa mite that we can't handle very well and the diseases that it vectors, then when you start talking about trace amounts of insecticides in the bees knocking down their immune system, then these diseases take the bees over. So it is still, it's that big complex. So there's not going to be a simple way. The trick is to try to get everything to back off. And, of course, my way of looking at this is if the incoming pollen and exposure to the pesticides while the bees are on those blooms is going to be a problem, most of the toxic chemicals already say do not apply this to blooming plants. And so if out in the ag world and whatnot, during the time that a bee-attractive crop was in bloom, nobody sprayed it with a toxic material, I don't think we'd see nearly the problems that we have with our honeybees at this point in time.
Well, we're getting – so you are in favor of the EPA proposal, right?
Oh, yeah, I've been after the EPA for a long, long time. They know me well,
yeah.
And I've pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. So, yes, I definitely want them to do some things. But even the one I looked at now, what they're saying in that proposal is they're going to put more pressure on the growers of these crops to not put these acutely toxic materials on during bloom. Well, if they do that, they kill their own bees. So that's not really where the bees get in trouble. What happens is, first of all, since honeybees need a varied diet, they're not going to all stay on the crop anyway. They go somewhere else. And if other attractive blooms are around in that area and other people are applying these materials that the grower wouldn't because he didn't want to lose his bees, they'll get into trouble anyway. And I think that's where most of them do get into trouble is off-site. Somewhere else where somebody else has made an application on something that's attracted to the bees. And if it's a material that's labeled, don't put this on bloom when bees are there, then those applications are in violation of the label.
And again, Eric Musson is Extension Apiculturalist Emeritus, UC Davis's Department of Entomology. I want to read some of your comments, some opinions coming through here that I want to get on the air. Beth writes, we have a couple of hives, as do many of our neighbors here in the Sierra, and some of our friends in the San Joaquin Valley. Why did it take the federal government so long to do something? Between this drought and the bees dying off, I sometimes wonder how many Californians even know where their food comes from and the huge role water and bees play. Another listener, Will, sends this to us by email. Why are herbicides like Roundup still sprayed by the ton by government and private organizations? Now that the World Health Organization says Roundup is a likely carcinogen, let's stop spraying our schools and open spaces with this bee killer. Bob writes, years ago, we took out our front lawn and planted drought-tolerant flowers, which also support bees and hummingbirds. Maybe you don't have a lawn to replace, but everybody can plant a few bee-friendly flowers in a pot somewhere. Don't wait for the government to save us. A couple of other tweets that I want to read here. maybe I can go to you on this, Kendall Sager. This is Christopher who says, can you please ask for resources and tips for starting a honeybee colony from scratch? He's got 10 acres south of Gilroy. What would you say to him?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest things that I can recommend is join your local guild or association. If you just search online for a honeybee guild in the name of your county, you'll typically find one. And a lot of these guilds offer classes and resources and experienced beekeepers to help you out. In the San Mateo Beekeepers Guild, we've got a new mentoring program to help new beekeepers through their first year, which is often one of the most challenging years. And we also do kind of a share program. Like, you can definitely find locally raised honeybees, or you can buy bees in packages. So it's good for sourcing your bees as well.
Let me go to another tweet, actually, for you, Kendall. Also, this is Nelson, who says, what can I, as an urban gardener, do to help the local bee population? How can I tell if a plant I buy has bad pesticides?
Well, one of the better ways is to ask. A lot of the smaller nurseries, like I personally really love Wegmans in Redwood City, they're really amazing at having like more natural plants than you would find at Osh and Home Depot. But I would really recommend looking at that Xerxes Society website to know that you're providing a good amount of nectar and pollen. And I believe pollinator.org actually says if they're going to that plant for pollen or nectar, because not all the plants you're going to find in that garden store are actually going to be good for bees. They might not forage on that.
We've put Xerxes up on our website, Tina.
Fantastic.
Now, trust me. And so that information can be accessed. Let me go back, Claire Kremen, to you, and an email from Michael who writes, what about the completely unregulated commercial beekeeping industry? They treat bees rather like an asset, apply multiple chemicals and antibiotics on a regular basis, feed on natural diet like brewery yeast and corn fructose, corn syrup, and do not allow bees to grow their own bodily tissue by forcing them to live on large implants called foundations. And then the effects on backyard beekeepers due to diseases being spread from commercial operations into local beekeepers.
I would completely agree that honeybees are being used as an input in our farming system. You know, as I mentioned before, with monoculture, you need so many bees. So you just basically bring them. It's like an input. It's like your fertilizer or your pesticides. Just bring in the honeybees. So, yeah, I really do think that we should be trying to build up our native pollinators as well. And what we need to do there is really change our farming system. That's going to help honeybees and native bees. So we could get away from the sort of input.
Actually, one more comment. Lisa writes, professional beekeepers are part of the problem. Bringing bees together into the almond orchards from all over the country spreads viruses and other diseases among the population. Much like human spread disease, when we congregate, the bee populations, already stressed and weakened from travel, are not strong enough to withstand exposure to new diseases. Eric Musson, you want to comment on that?
Well, it is true that here in the almonds, I mean, you can't get in much more of a blending pot of bees. They do tend to, we call it drift. They do tend to not get back necessarily into the colony that they came from. And when we have so many colonies out here all at the same time, it's awfully, awfully hard to not get some of the problem that this neighbor down the street happened to have in his or her bees or whatever. I mean, that is the way that it is. But I don't know what to say other than the fact that it looks like the almond acreage is continuing to expand, and those individuals growing the nuts are going to have the pollination, and they will pay a high enough price to lure these beekeepers in. And many of the beekeepers now are financially set in such a manner that if they didn't have the almond income, they couldn't keep the colony alive for the whole year.
And what are almonds at now? 10% of water use in California and probably rising. You wanted to add something, Kendall Sager?
Yeah, I think just so that you're aware of the magnitude that this really is, I think a few years ago there was a statistic that it takes 2/3 of the United States honeybee colonies to pollinate almond orchards. So that's, I think, little over 1 million beehives. So it's really a huge number of bees from as far away as like the East Coast are being trucked into California.
Can you confirm those numbers, Eric Musson?
Yeah, she's a little bit on the short side. We're almost at 1 million acres of almonds now. And we require almost 2 colonies per acre. So we need about 2 million colonies of bees out here in California now in February and early March. And we've got about 500,000 in California. So the other 1.5 million do have to be trucked in from other states across the country.
Yeah, Claire. And that, which is also certainly hurting the climate change the environment in terms of all that gasoline? I'm sorry, fossil fuel. Claire Kremen.
So I do think there's other ways to do it. For example, some of our research has shown that when you have native pollinators and honeybees on the same almond field, the native pollinators, through their interactions with honeybees, actually make the honeybees twice as efficient. So that means that if you could have native pollinators on all of our almond fields, which we definitely do not because of the habitat, poor habitat quality, but if you could have native pollinators on all of those farm fields, we would need half as many honeybees, which is pretty amazing right there. And so we wouldn't have to bring in so many honeybees. We wouldn't have to have all of these mixing issues that lead to the disease problems.
Because so, I don't know if listeners realize it, but they're brought in by the truckloads.
They're brought in by the truckloads. Yeah. So what could we do to change this? And what we really need to do is right here in California is re-diversify our farm fields. We need to put flowering plant hedgerows around the borders of all of the fields. We need to maybe sacrifice a little bit of land to put some insectary plants, that is plants that attract pollinators and support them inside the farm fields. We need to think about having smaller farm fields that have different kinds of bloom so that there's different things going on in the landscape within the foraging range of bees. So, you know, we really could reimagine our farming landscapes. We don't have to do it exactly like we are doing it just because that's how we have always done it. There are different ways we could go about this.
And a tweet from John, who writes, how about the Federal Highway Administration stop spraying to let weeds grow to feed bees across a wide network of medians? Let me go to more of your calls. We'll go to San Carlos. Stephanie, you're on. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I recently listened to a broadcast at the Harvard School of Public Health Forum in which they discussed pesticides. One of the researchers said that the neonicotinoids are put on the outside of seeds, yet they're incorporated throughout the plant. And in corn, they're incorporated into the high fructose corn syrup. That is fed to the bees and is probably responsible, presumably, for part of the problem. I also wonder if it's in the high fructose corn syrup that all of the rest of us are eating. But that's a separate issue.
Yeah, well,
this is
Eric.
Let me comment on this. Yes, that statement was made by somebody out of Harvard, and then a number of people went back to the manufacturers and to the product on the market and everything else. And because of the way that the corn is handled and converted into high fructose corn syrup, there is no residue of the neonics in high fructose corn syrup. Oh. It can't survive the treatment that the corn starch goes through.
Yeah, let me thank you, Stephanie, for that call. And I want to get to a beekeeper here. David from Kensington, welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I live a mile north of Berkeley. I have two hives. I've had those hives here for 40 years, and I just want to introduce a positive note to the generally negative tone of the program, unfortunately. I have harvested over 160 pounds of honey from my two hives this year, and I'm going to harvest another 60 pounds in about a week. I've introduced some new beekeeping methods in the last year or so. And I'd be happy to share those with people, but I just want to let people know that it's possible to have positive results from a hive, even in these drought years. So.
You want to give a secret or two out here?
secret.
reason for your success?
Yeah. Yes. Two kinds of miticides that I'm using. One I learned from a website in New Zealand. The other is kind of standard, using mitaway strips. Second is I've fed protein patties to the bees in the fall. And the third thing is that I've added an enormous amount of room so the bees didn't swarm. So they were just super, super strong, still are super strong. They've been strong for about a year. I've never seen anything like this before. I'm same habitat that they're feeding on. Nothing's changed. This is my 41st year with the same hives in the same location.
Love to hear that success story, David. Thank you for it.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Much obliged for that call. And let me get to another caller from Palo Alto. Charlie, join us. You're on forum.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment briefly. Utilizing your local landscape gardener or landscape architect as well in terms of a resource. I once had a notion where I noticed on a field trip with some people a multitude of over 15 local pollinators on the local coffee berry plant in Marin on a day hike, and I was amazed at the different blue flies and local insects I had never even noticed before, and small gnats on the microflowers. Something I learned when I was at UC Berkeley, but I'd never witnessed. And I was just amazed at the overlap And I also wanted to segue into the concern about glyphosate as well on a residential and commercial agricultural level. I'd be concerned about the amount of glyphosate on the highways and residential and application kind of, and the need for a health concern, just a health awareness, I guess, in terms of public health awareness, I can take off the line now. Thank you.
Okay. We thank you for that call. And we've only got about a minute left here. What would be in order here, sort of in a wish list, Clara Kremen, top for you?
Top wish list for me is to really work on rediversifying our agricultural landscape so they can be more supportive of native pollinators and also of our honeybees, and get us off of this dependence on trucking honeybees across the country, which I just think is kind of a crazy thing to do.
And to you, Eric Musson, same question.
Well, until Claire's ideas come to fruition and things change out there so that we don't need to think that we have to control all of our pests with pesticides and whatnot, I still wanted to look deeper into finding out what in the world some of these materials are doing to the bees, because it's I'm convinced that they're heavily involved in some manner, but I also know we don't understand it well enough yet.
Yeah, and I assume you mean pesticide material. Claire Sager. Kendall Sager, excuse me. Final word from you. We've got seconds left here.
No worries. Plant for pollinators, keep beehives, and support your local honey producers.
Good place to end. Thank you all. Thanks to Clara Kremen from UC Berkeley and the Berkeley Food Institute, to Kendall Sager, also with us in studio from the Beekeepers Guild of San Mateo County, and Eric Musson from UC Davis Department of Entomology. We also spoke to Lorianne Bird from the Center for Biological Diversity. And we thank you for being a part of this program. Another hour up ahead, we're going to talk to Randy Shaw all about the Tenderloin. He's been working there as an activist and lawyer for over 30 years and has written a book, in fact, called The Tenderloin. We're also eager to hear from you. If you have thoughts about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear, you can email us, forum@kqed.org. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor, Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.